as the cost of solar and the cost of storage come down and EV and electric vehicles start to gain greater prominence, it seems inevitable that certain locations will find it beneficial to them to become what we call a microgrid today.
The microgrid is, well, whatever you want it to be. It can incorporate solar and storage, serve all your neighbors with heat and power, or just be backup in case the grid goes out. It can also support an electric vehicle, utilize smart thermostats and water heaters, automatically balance your power in an economic way. You get the idea. Microgrids naturally bend the rules between utility and customer, between supply and load. Now that so many are being developed, they're testing the regulatory boundaries that allowed electric utilities to keep captive customers for the past century. Chris Villarreal, Director of Policy for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, talks with John Farrell today about microgrids, where they're used, and what rules can govern their use today. This is Local Energy Rules, a podcast sharing powerful stories about local renewable energy.
So, Chris, let's start with the basics. What is a microgrid, and why would anybody want one?
A microgrid is basically a subset of the grid. Customers on the grid that decided to band together and utilize their own power sources to create a higher level of reliability amongst themselves or to allow themselves to become islands off of the grid for their own purposes, either in response to personal needs or to market or grid situations. Why would some entities want that? Well, some groups or some locations, like say a shopping mall, may want to allow their customers to continue shopping in the event of a blackout, where they, especially in the summer, where they can continue to produce air conditioning on a hot summer day. Other locations may want a higher level of reliability in response to frequent outages or intermittent voltage support so that they can continue operating without losing any time or money at that location. And so there's a good sense that some larger and aggregated areas of the grid may want to see themselves become islanded in the event of either a blackout or a brownout, or just because they want to do it themselves and think they can do it better than their incumbent utility for what.
So maybe this will lead into certain answers to this next question. It sounds like reliability is a big reason why folks would be interested in developing microgrids. Could you give us a couple of examples of where we might find microgrids?
Sure. So immediate answer to those are usually going to be found on places where power cannot go out regardless of the circumstance, places like large industrial facilities or, as we're seeing in lots of places across the country and in the world, military installations, where the military wants to utilize their existing infrastructure but can't be without power for any amount of time from the local company. So you see things going on at like the LA Air Force Base and at other facilities in California where they are investing in a wide variety of distributed energy resources so that they can better manage their own uses, both to meet existing administration-led climate change policies, but also to ensure that they have a highly reliable sense of electricity in the event that the grid is taken down, either just due to a blackout or for other purposes like a cyber or a physical event. Other areas would include things like hospitals or transit facilities. You see that going on in the New England states in response to Superstorm Sandy, where you had identified locations such as hospitals or police stations or even the transit system in New Jersey that is now seeing a large amount of investment to become self-sustainable through microgrids to allow for those areas of the grid to come up faster than others because of the public safety needs of those facilities.
So there's been a lot of hype. Well, I should say there's a lot of hype about microgrids for energy nerds like you and me who pay a lot of attention to the electricity world. But most of the examples that we have of microgrids that were built in the past are, you know, like you said, they're these kind of essential service places, military bases or hospitals. And the main technology that was being used was diesel generators. What's exciting or different about the microgrids that, you know, we're hearing about now or that are being built, you know, in the wake of Hurricane Sandy?
Sure. So what we're seeing today is with the proliferation and the ongoing cost reductions in distributed energy resources, including rooftop solar and electric vehicles and even energy storage. We're seeing these costs come down, which make it more cost effective for locations, aggregate locations, to meet their own reliability needs. So you can see shopping malls that can put rooftop solar on their roof and also offer electric vehicle charging to customers with electric vehicles. And now the shopping center becomes its own little grid. The shopping center now becomes responsible for maintaining the load and the reliability for its customers, both the stores as well as the shoppers, and can better manage it and see where they can find greater efficiencies. At the end of the day, it may turn out that that shopping center may end up producing more power than it needs, in which case it can completely island itself, if necessary, from the grid, which provides an overall efficiency to the grid, which means the utility no longer needing to procure power from central station power plants. It could now be self-generated at that local location. That local location can also then be used to provide additional services onto the grid if the grid becomes constrained. So if you have a location on the distribution grid or even the transmission grid that is constrained, now you have a microgrid sitting out there that can act as a load, that can now act as a load and soak up a lot of power. Or in the reverse of that, if the local grid needs power, the microgrid can now all of a sudden provide a tremendous amount of power all at one point. And we're not talking simply about electricity, but it can also provide additional ancillary services such as volt VAR support and just be available capacity. What then becomes required is how to best allow those microgrids to interact directly with the distribution company. So that's where you're seeing the use of new technologies to allow for that interconnection between the utility and the microgrid. So where you see things like point of common coupling and interconnection tariffs start to come into focus on how to make these interactions actually happen in a way that is both beneficial to the microgrid, beneficial to the utility, beneficial to the customers, all without interrupting the reliability of the utility network.
I'm glad that you got into this question of how these facilities connect to the grid, because, you know, there are a few ways in which, you know, from a regulatory perspective or even a legal perspective, microgrids are kind of a challenge. You know, we have a history in terms of the development of the grid in many states, including Minnesota. You have these vertically integrated monopoly utility companies. They own the generation, they own the power lines, everything up to the meter that's on the property. And microgrids, especially ones that involve multiple customers, involve kind of crossing some of that property that's traditionally been the utility space or crossing public property, you know, just to name a couple of the interesting challenges. You know, what do you see as the biggest barrier to deploying microgrids in various states across the country?
Well, I think there are a number of challenges to microgrids. There's technological challenges as well as economic challenges. On the technological challenges, there's the upfront cost of the investment for the microgrid operator to make. How is that investment made? For what purpose are they doing that investment? And then once you have that in place, then you have the policy and technological barrier of the interconnection, potentially the interconnection tariff itself. So there are a number of technologies that are being increasingly invested in by microgrid operators as well as other DER resources such as smart inverters, which can help mitigate some of the technological and engineering risks that heretofore have restricted the ability of DER to participate more effectively with the distribution grid. We have existing standards that underlie the interconnection tariff in the middle of being updated to reflect the changing condition of distributed resources such as microgrids to becoming a benefit to the grid. Standards like UL 1741, which is a safety standard that allows for distributed resources like a microgrid to safely interconnect and then respond in response to a power outage without sending power back online, back up into the grid, is in the middle of being updated and should be finalized sometime this year. The existing interconnection tariffs utilize a prior version of the standard which prohibits islanding. You know, they're called anti-islanding standards, which are beneficial to the perspective of the grid operator and the line worker who goes out to make sure that to repair the line, you obviously do not want current flowing through it. So having the standard be updated to reflect the changing technological conditions will be a great benefit and will at least lower that technological barrier to the microgrid operator. On the economic side, the reason to do that is not only to do higher reliability, but potentially to make some money off of it on the back end by providing additional services to the grid, be it the distribution or the wholesale grid. Having policies that allow for those benefits to be valued and priced and paid for will also provide is currently a barrier to greater micro development because those policies are generally not in place in most of the country. In other words, the wholesale market has prices for energy and capacity and ancillary services, things like regulation and frequency and non-spin. If you have a large enough resource at a particular location, that resource, like the microgrid, can respond to that. But if the policies are not in place to allow those resources to interact with the wholesale market, that's a barrier. Additionally, on the distribution side, the same situation applies. If you have location of the distribution grid where a microgrid could provide an economic benefit, those services are currently not priced or valued today. So there's lost economic benefit from the microgrid with the distribution grid as a whole, where it could provide additional benefits if it was allowed to participate in existing utility programs.
So say, for example, you've got a hospital that has a microgrid and it's got solar and some energy storage and whatnot. You know, there are services that it could offer the grid, say if there was, you know, more energy use right then than the grid would typically supply, there was congestion. But what I'm hearing you say is that there isn't a way for the hospital to really sell that into the market. There's no pricing for that. There's no market for that in most places. So that hospital is really just going to have to make the economics work on its microgrid on the basis of the backup power rather than being able to make money providing something of value to the grid.
Correct. It would have to do it that way, as well as the avoided cost of otherwise paying its utility bill. So if its utility bill is, you know, say $1,000 a month, but they're able to use their microgrid some of the time to reduce that bill by $200, that's a $200 a month savings. They could extract greater benefit if they're allowed to do things on top of that for where the grid would value the services and perhaps it's more than $200 a month, or maybe it's on top of the $200 a month on the bill savings.
So, you know, right now there's not really a standardized microgrid either in terms of the business model or in terms of the technical design, but we're starting to see examples of, you know, so-called advanced microgrids that can serve multiple users and combine different points of generation. Can you explain a few different ways in which states that are sort of out front on this are helping promote the development of these community microgrids?
Sure. So some states like in Hawaii and California, which are seeing a tremendous growth in distributed energy resources at the distribution level, are seeing a wider variety of needs at the distribution level to respond to things like the wholesale market operator that we traditionally think of. In response to that, you're seeing end-use customers, such as Santa Rita Jail in Santa Clara County, I believe, California, take it upon themselves to invest in the microgrid themselves and manage their power in a way that can avoid a higher retail rate. To some extent, the microgrid really is whatever the microgrid operator or the location wants it to do. It could do as few of things as just provide backup power, or it could provide as many of things as interacting in a transactive manner with electricity grid and its nearby microgrid operators. It's not just one flavor, but it's a wide variety of flavors that a microgrid can do. As long as the engineering and the grid architecture components are put in place to allow for this quote-unquote open access interaction with the grid and with customers next to it, it's really a wide open world right now in the way microgrids can operate and perform in the future with the appropriate policies put in place. Again, if you look at Hawaii and California, where they're seeing a greater need on distribution, microgrids would seem to be a good candidate for supporting the distribution company with the needs that it identifies to support the reliability as well as the resilience of the grid at a local level or at a county or at a service territory-wide level, however the utility decides its needs are to maintain reliability and resilience.
Even though some, in sort of the traditional view, some utilities might look at microgrids as sort of a little competing utility, what I hear you saying is really they can be complements to what the utility is already providing because it's a resource that has a lot of different potential to, provide support to the grid, and especially if there is a market structure such that the microgrid operator can see some revenue from that and, you know, commensurate with the benefit they're providing to the grid.
In my opinion, the microgrid could be a good partner with the utility to provide all the localized needs of the microgrid's customers as well as localized needs of the utility's customers. How that is constructed, as it occurs to me, there may be an additional policy and legal barrier to the microgrid development is if states have defined terms for what is a utility. And if a microgrid falls within that legal term of being, for example, a reseller of electricity. So understanding the legal construct of how a microgrid can fit in, even in these leading states, is going to be an ongoing discussion at that state level.
Because if a microgrid, for example, were defined as a utility based on the way that it was operating, it might be subject to particular regulation or limitations that are in state law for other reasons.
Correct.
So, you know, a few of the kind of prominent analysis organizations out there, Navigant and Green Tech Media, have said, you know, the amount of capacity in microgrids is going to either double or triple in the next decade. Do you think they're right that this is, you know, on a really accelerating growth curve? You know, why or why not?
I haven't the slightest idea. I think if you'd ask anyone except the most ardent believers in solar, if we would see the prices for solar today that we are, I don't think anyone would agree with that. I am in no position today to predict what the growth of microgrids will look like over the rest of the decade. What I can say at a macro level is that the distribution grid is in the evolutionary stage today as consumers are able to take greater control over their usage and work with other providers to help them with the services and the needs that the customer so desires. As the cost of solar and the cost of storage come down and EV and electric vehicles start to gain greater prominence, it seems inevitable that certain locations will find it beneficial to them to become what we call a microgrid today. And those locations will continue to proliferate in size, be it the shopping center, the military installation, an apartment building, or just the new neighborhood that's being constructed out in the suburbs of a given city. These are all opportunities for microgrid development. If the economics are put in place and the grid is constructed in such a way to allow these things to operate in a safe and reliable manner, it seems with both of those conditions in place, the ability of microgrids becomes not a matter of if, but a matter of when. And whether that is done by the end of the decade, within the next 10 years or 15 years, I can't say, but the only thing I can seem to say is that we will see an increasing amount of microgrids over the next decade to two decades.
That was Chris Villarreal, Director of Policy for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, talking with John Farrell, ILSR's Director of Democratic Energy. More information on microgrids and their macro potential and macro barriers can be found within ILSR's new report, Mighty Microgrids, on ILSR.org. There you can also find more local energy rules podcasts. Until next time, keep your energy local, and thanks for listening.